Pericles, a very well-referenced and well-known man. He lived in the 400 BCs, from 495 to 429 BC. Pericles was an extremely influential statesman and orator for and general of Athens, essentially. He was known as having a wonderful, influential voice and seemed to have a lot of respect for his capacity for public speaking. At the time in Athens, the speech we're going to go over is his funeral oration. And at the time in Athens, it was commonplace that every year they would get together and honor the dead. There was a ceremonial kind of recognition of those who had gone, and because of the almost constant state of war, there was always some form of funeral needing to be done. But at this particular time, it was the beginning of the Peloponnesian Wars, and so there had been quite a large amount of death occur. And it was here that Pericles was asked to give a speech to the people. And this was unique because it was one of the few times where all of Athens gathered, including the women, the elderly, the men, the children, that it was an opportunity for somebody to communicate to all people, but it was the solemn occasion. And because of the nature of the wars and the capacity to bring home the bodies, there was many of the bodies were not returned home, and so it would have been some cases scattered bones, in some cases empty coffins. It was a unique kind of setting where there wasn't always a body there, but it was a chance to honor all those who had been lost. And this speech is referenced and it is used in modern day speeches, and you'll see the traces of it in many of the leaders that we have over the last century referencing it. So I will crack in. We're very fortunate to have this. This is very old speech, 431 BC, at a very pertinent and pressing time. So I really like the tone and the way that he tackles this whole situation, where he's able to keep a sincere human touch while also being very statesmanlike. I'll kick it off. Most of those who have spoken here before me have commended the lawgiver who added this oration to our other funeral customs. It seemed to them a worthy thing that such an honor should be given at their burial to the dead who have fallen on the field of battle. But I should have preferred that when men's deeds have been brave, they should be honored in deed only, and with such an honor as this public funeral, which you are now witnessing. Then the reputation of many would not have been imperiled on the eloquence or want of eloquence of one, and their virtues, believed or not as he spoke well or ill. For it is difficult to say neither too little nor too much, and even moderation is apt not to give the impression of truthfulness. The friend of the dead who knows the facts is likely to think that the words of the speaker fall short of his knowledge and of his wishes. Another who is not so well informed when he hears of anything which surpasses his own powers will be envious and will suspect exaggeration. Mankind are tolerant of the praises of others so long as each hearer thinks that he can do as well or nearly as well himself. But when the speaker rises above him, jealousy is aroused and he begins to be incredulous. However, since our ancestors have set the seal of their approval upon the practice, I must obey, and to the utmost of my power, shall endeavor to satisfy the wishes and beliefs of all. Just briefly there. Pericles's just messaging is that there's basically words are almost not enough to satisfy this. I mean, they're going to overstate it or understate it. How can I, someone who knows so little or knows too much, there'll be jealousy, there'll be envy, so all these things, and I feel like words are not enough. That's how I interpret that. But he also accepts the challenge and says, I agree because of the nature of the situation. I'll continue. I will speak first of our ancestors, for it is right and seemly that now, when we are lamenting the dead, a tribute should be paid to their memory. There has never been a time when they did not inhabit this land, which by their valor they will have handed down from generation to generation, and we have received from them a free state. But if they were worthy of praise, still more were our fathers, who added to their inheritance, and after many a struggle, transmitted to us their sons this great empire. And we ourselves assembled here today, who are still most of us in the vigor of life, have carried the work of improvement further, and have richly endowed our city with all things, so that she is sufficient for herself both in peace and war. Of the military exploits by which our various possessions were acquired, or of the energy with which we or our fathers drove back the tide of war, Hellenic or barbarian, I will not speak, for the tale would be long and is familiar to you. But before I praise the dead, I should like to point out by what principles of action we rose to power, and under what institutions and through what manner of life our empire became great. For I conceive that such thoughts are not unsuited to the occasion, and that this numerous assembly of citizens and strangers may profitably listen to them. Just that, but praising, just I'm just pausing us a moment, that just the praising of the past, praising of the dead, and understanding where they come from and how they got to where they are. Is, I think, an important part of laying the foundation of the message he's about to share. I'll continue. Our form of government does not enter into rivalry with the institutions of others. Our government does not copy our neighbors, but is an example to them. It is true that we are called a democracy, for the administration is in the hands of the many and not of the few. But while there exists equal justice to all and alike in the private disputes, the claim of excellence is also recognized. And when a citizen is in any way distinguished, he is preferred to the public service, not as a matter of privilege, but as the reward of merit. Neither is poverty an obstacle, but a man may benefit his country, whatever the obscurity of his condition. There is no exclusiveness in our public life. And in our private business, we are not suspicious of one another, nor angry with our neighbor if he does what he likes. We do not put on sour looks at him, which, though harmless, are not pleasant. While we are thus unconstrained in our private business, our spirit of reverence pervades our public acts. We are prevented from doing wrong by respect for the authorities and for the laws, having a particular regard to those which are ordained for the protection of the injured, as well as those unwritten laws which bring upon the transgressor of them the reprobation of general sentiment. And we have not forgotten to provide for our weary spirits many relaxations from toil. We have regular games and sacrifices throughout the year. Our homes are beautiful and elegant, and the delight which we daily feel in all these things helps to banish sorrow. Because of the greatness of our city, the fruits of the whole earth flow in upon us, so that we enjoy the goods of other countries as freely as our own. Just pause in the speech. He is acknowledging the beneficial state that they're in, the beauty which they enjoy, the homes, the freedom, the ability to be able to live your life. Whether you're poor or rich, you can contribute. There is this message that is ingrained within Athens at this time. I'll continue on. Then again, our military training is in many respects superior to that of our adversaries. Our city is thrown open to the world, though, and we never expel a foreigner and prevent him from seeing or learning anything of which the secret, if revealed to an enemy, might profit him. We rely not upon management or trickery, but upon our own hearts and hands. And in the matter of education, whereas they from early youth are always undergoing laborious exercises which are to make them brave, we live at ease, and yet are equally ready to face the perils which they face. And here is the proof. The Lacedaemonians come into Athenian territory not by themselves, but with their whole confederacy following, we go alone into a neighbor's country, and although our opponents are fighting for their homes, and we on a foreign soil, we have seldom any difficulty in overcoming them. Our enemies have never yet felt our united strength. The care of a navy divides our attention, and on land we are obliged to send our own citizens everywhere. But they, if they meet and defeat a part of our army, are as proud as if they had routed us all, and when defeated they pretend to have been vanquished by us all. If then we prefer to meet danger with a light heart, but without laborious training, and with courage, which is gained by habit and not enforced by law, we are not greatly the better for it, since we do not anticipate the pain, although when the hour comes, we can be as brave as those who never allow themselves to rest. Thus our city is equally admirable in peace and in war, for we are lovers of the beautiful in our taste, and our strength lies in our opinion, not in deliberation and discussion, but that knowledge which is gained by discussion preparatory to action. For we have peculiar power of thinking before we act, and of acting too, whereas other men are courageous from ignorance, but hesitate upon reflection. And they are surely to be esteemed the bravest spirits who, having the clearest sense both of the pains and pleasures of life, do not on that account shrink from danger. In doing good, again, we are unlike others. We make our friends by conferring, not by receiving favors. Now he who confers a favor is the firmer friend, because he would rather be by kindness keep alive the memory of an obligation. But the recipient is colder in his feelings, because he knows that in requiting another's generosity, he will not be winning gratitude, but only paying a debt. We alone do good to our neighbors, not upon a calculation of interest, but in confidence of freedom and in a frank and fearless spirit. To sum up, I say that Athens is the school of Hellas, and that the individual Athenian in his own person seems to have the power of adapting himself to the most varied forms of action with the utmost versatility and grace. This is no passing and idle word, but truth and fact, and the assertion is verified by the position to which these qualities have raised the state. For in the hour of trial of Athens, alone among her contemporaries is superior to the report of her. No enemy who comes against her is indignant at the reverses which he sustains at the hand of such a city. No subject complains that his masters are unworthy of him. And we shall assuredly not be without witnesses. There are mighty monuments of our power, which will make us the wonder of this and of succeeding ages. We shall not need the praise of Homer or of any other panegyrist whose poetry may please for the moment, although his representation of the facts will not bear the light of the day. For we have compelled every land and every sea to open a path for our valor, and have everywhere planted eternal memorials of our friendship and of our enmity. Such is the city for those for whose sake these men nobly fought and died. They could not bear the thought that she might be taken from them, and every one of us who survive should gladly toil on her behalf. Just to pause there, obviously he's now really laid out the, I suppose, the position of the people, the feeling of the people he's sending the message that they are good, really, that they are true to a cause, that they have a cause, that they are united, that they have moral reasons to do the things they do, that they have a why. He's really laying that out, and that is emphasized by the greatness of the city of Athens, that the people have made that happen, that the cause has made that happen. And because of that, the whole world wants to be there, and they are opened to the whole world. I'll continue on. Such was the end of these men. They were worthy of Athens, and the living need not desire to have a more heroic spirit, although they may pray for a less fatal issue. The value of such a spirit is not to be expressed in words. Anyone can discourse to you forever about the advantages of a brave defense, which you know already, but instead of listening to him, I would have you day by day fix your eyes upon the greatness of Athens until you become filled with the love of her. And when you are impressed by the spectacle of her glory, reflect that this empire has been acquired by men who knew their duty and had the courage to do it, who in the hour of conflict had the fear of dishonor always present to them, and who, if ever they failed in an enterprise, would not allow their virtues to be lost to their country, but freely gave their lives to her as the fairest offering which they could present at her feast. The sacrifice which they collectively made was individually repaid to them, for they received again each one for himself a praise which grows not old, and the noblest of all tombs. I speak not of that in which their remains are laid, but of that in which their glory survives and is proclaimed always on every fitting occasion, both in word and deed. For the whole earth is the tomb of famous men. Not only are they commemorated by columns and inscriptions in their own country, but in foreign lands there dwells also an unwritten memorial of them, graven not on stone but in the hearts of men. Make them your examples, and esteeming courage to be freedom and freedom to be happiness. Do not weigh too nicely the perils of war. The unfortunate who has no hope of change for the better has less reason to throw away his life than the prosperous who, if he survive, is always liable to a change for the worse, and to whom any accidental fall makes the most serious difference. To a man of spirit, cowardice and disaster coming together are far more bitter than death striking him unperceived at a time when he is full of courage and animated by the general hope. Just pause there. There is a lot of powerful lines there, but it's this idea that these men will be given tombs, but not graves, but honor and freedom and virtues, and that they will be engraved on the hearts of men, that their names will be engraved on the hearts of men, that they'll be known on their land and on lands abroad, is a very powerful motive, very powerful message to send to a people and to an individual. It's, in other words, it's better to die and be a hero than to live and be a cowardly, you know, wimpy person with no cause. It's kind of the message that there's worse things than death. I'll carry on. Wherefore, I do not now pity the parents of the dead who stand here. I would rather comfort them. You know that your dead have passed away amid manifold vicissitudes, and that they may be deemed fortunate who have gained their utmost honor, whether an honorable death like theirs or an honorable sorrow like yours, and whose share of happiness has been so ordered that the term of their happiness is likewise the term of their life. I know how hard it is to make you feel this when the good fortune of others will too often remind you of the gladness which once lined in your hearts, and sorrow is felt at the one of those blessings, not which a man never knew, but which were a part of his life before they were taken from him. Some of you are of an age at which they may hope to have other children, and they ought to bear their sorrow better. Not only will the children who may hereafter be born make them forget their own lost ones, but the city will be doubly a gainer. She will not be left a desolate. She will be safer, for a man's counsel cannot have equal weight or worth when he alone has no children to risk in the general danger. To those of you who have passed their prime, I say, congratulate yourselves that you have been happy during the greater part of your days. Remember that your life of sorrow will not last long, and be comforted by the glory of those who are gone. For the love of honor alone is ever young, and not riches, as some say, but honor is the delight of men when they are old and useless. Pause there. I mean, how could you go past that? He starts off by wanting to give comfort, and you know, it's hard to be comforted when you've lost so much. But if you can have kids, move on, have kids, and try to you know, lighten the pain by moving with extra children. But if you can't have children, you have honor. it's an interesting message. For love and honor alone is ever young, not riches. And that's true. Riches come and go, don't they? But I suppose it's how we feel, who we become, who those we love become, is the thing that goes with us, doesn't it? I'll keep going. To you who are the sons and brothers of the departed, I see that the struggle to emulate them will be an arduous one. For all men praise the dead, and however preeminent your virtue may be, I do not say even to approach them and avoid living their rivals and detractors. But when a man is out of the way, the honor and goodwill which he receives is unalloyed. And if I am to speak of womanly virtues, to those of you who will henceforth be wedded widows, let me sum them up in one short admonition. To a woman, not to show more weakness than is natural to her sex is a great glory, and not to be talked about for good or for evil among men. I have paid the required tribute in obedience to the law, making use of such fitting words as I had. The tribute of deeds has been paid in part, for the dead have them in deeds, and it remains only that their children should be maintained at the public charge until they are grown up. This is the solid prize with which, as with a garland, Athens crowns her sons, living and dead, after a struggle like theirs. For where the rewards of virtue are greatest, there the noblest citizens are enlisted in the service of the state. And now, when you have duly lamented every one his own dead, you may depart. So that is the conclusion of Pericles' funeral oration. It's when you hear these speeches, and I've said this before, it's the stage that's set that allows the power of the speech to reach greater heights. It's the experiences that come before the speech. It's the feelings that are happening during the speech that make it what it is. Speaking to a crowd of mothers and fathers and sons and brothers and sisters of people who have died, and trying to give a message that is going to be of some value, is an absolute scene. To do it at one funeral, I don't know if you've ever been to a funeral, but if you go to a funeral, having to give the speech for one person it's emotional. But to have to do it for a city's worth, there would have been lamenting and noise and crying and all sorts of things. And yet here he is giving his message, and it is very much tied to the cause of the men who died. It's tied to the cause of Athens. It's tied to honor, but it's also tied to peace and humanity. Thanks for listening. I look forward to seeing you again soon, as we share more great speeches.